Thank you, team. Thank you very much. I wanted to mention one other thing quickly before I get into the sermon this morning. If you saw this blue insert regarding the election day coming up and our prayer focus on that, this has been a crazy election, right? I mean, it is just, I'm like, how can this get any more bizarre, any more depressing, any more crazy? But our role, in addition to voting, as we feel the Lord leads us in that regard, is certainly to pray. So what we want to do, you'll see in the lower part of this insert, we've set aside this coming week, starting on Tuesday through the following Monday, the eve of Election Day, to encourage you, to encourage us as a body to be in prayer. Now, I know there's a lot of prayer things. There have been 40-day prayer things going on around the internet. You've probably seen many of them. But we wanted to take this week leading up to the election just to encourage you to be praying, and for whatever reason, the last line got cut off here. It says, if you've provided your email to the church, we'll also send you, and then I guess it's sort of up to you to interpret what we're going to send you. But I'll fill that in. Beginning Tuesday of this week, we will send a churchwide email at 5 a.m. every morning. At 5 a.m. every morning, with a different prayer emphasis for the day, with just an encouragement for you to be praying. So be watching that. If we don't have your email, this is an opportunity for you to give it to us so you can be a part of that. We're just going to try to hold that in front of ourselves every day this week as we head up to the election. So we encourage you to do that. And then next Sunday, 2 days before the election, we're going to give our morning really to that theme. We'll have a time of corporate prayer. So the things that the Lord is stirring in you this week as you're praying for the election, you'll be able to come and maybe share a scripture the Lord puts on your heart, share a prayer with the rest of the body. So that's a little bit of what next Sunday will look like coming up to the actual election. And then the following week, the following Sunday, which will be the first Sunday after the election, we are going to do what Scripture commands us to do. We are going to pray for our new president, whoever that is. I'm trusting that we will know who the president is by then. I don't count on anything in this election, you know. In the Bush-Gore election, there was quite a period of time, actually, until the Supreme Court actually settled who the president was. But trusting that we will have an outcome, we are going to pray for the president because we're commanded to do that. So that we'll be doing 2 Sundays from now. So, okay, I'm going to jump in here this morning. This has been a great morning. Again, thank you, team. I love this theme of stepping forward in identity. I love Deb's testimony. It's been fun watching Deb and watching this happening in her life. God calling her into Operation Christmas Child several years ago, and then he keeps opening more doors for her. She keeps stepping further and further and higher in the organization. And it's just been a blessing to watch. So yeah, this has been a great morning, a very encouraging message of stepping forward. God will make you brave. God will give you what you need. So I'm figuring like somebody has to cast a wet blanket on the whole thing. Right? Like somebody's got to come along and do that. So it might as well be me. I'm just kidding, sort of. Here's the deal. Here's the sermon in a sentence or two, and then we'll develop it a lot more. You must know this. You must be aware of this. As you step forward into something new that God is calling you into, in a new realm of authority, a new realm of responsibility, a new realm of identity, when you do that, are you listening? When you do that, you will encounter resistance. I hate to break the news, but you will. You will encounter resistance because we have an enemy in this spiritual battle. We have an enemy in our walk with the Lord, and you will encounter resistance. Now, I don't say that to discourage you, please. It might sound discouraging in the moment, but it's just something you have to be aware of because if you're not aware of that, you take a step into new identity, authority, responsibility, and you encounter resistance. And you may say this to yourself, I guess I wasn't supposed to take this step because I'm finding it difficult. I thought it would be easy, but I'm finding it difficult, so maybe I didn't hear God right. That's a lie of the enemy. Please, if you don't understand anything else this morning, just get that. That is a lie of the enemy. When God calls you to step forward, the enemy's going to resist you. So, we've been on this journey regarding David. I've taken some of the identity themes we've been focusing on over the summer, and we've looked at them in the life of David. Last Sunday, the sermon title was Ziklag, Hebron, or Jerusalem, and I looked at the last few years of David's life leading up to the time when he actually became king over all Israel. This event that had been prophesied in his life, maybe 10 or 15 years or maybe even more earlier, was finally coming to pass. But before it came to pass, he went through a place that was called Ziklag, which I suggested last week was a place of detour for David. He was almost running from God a little bit. He got caught up in this zone in Ziklag where I don't think he should have been. He was sort of withdrawing from the battle a little bit. But then God called him out of Ziklag when Saul was killed and moved him to Hebron. And there in Hebron, he was made king of Judah, which was the southern portion of the whole nation of Israel. But it wasn't the whole thing. He had been prophesied. It was just part of it. And he had to wait 7 more years until he was made king over all of Israel. We talked about that last week, but then I suggested that even though David is now in the place that he was prophesied to be, Jerusalem, the city of David, king over all Israel, that there were still challenges that waited for him. And that's what we're going to look at today. We're going to look at some of these challenges. So for those of you who this morning felt like this was sort of a culmination or maybe just a reminder that God is indeed calling you forward into something, God is not calling you into that thing because it's going to be a place of your recliner and resting and your feet up. He's calling you into that place because he has work for you to do there. Okay? He has work for you to do there. And when you're working for him in that place, you're going to have some challenges. It's part of the package. Reflect for a moment on these two scriptural situations very quickly. Many of you are familiar with the man Moses, okay? Moses was raised in the courts of Pharaoh, all the best training I'm sure that Egypt had. And I think Moses felt like he was something, like he had something to offer. And he tried to step in one day in a certain situation with his people Israel, that he was actually an Israelite. And he tried to take matters into his own hands, and it didn't go well, and he had to flee. And Moses spent the next 40 years of his life, 40 years of his life in the desert as a shepherd. And he had to think, like, my life is totally useless. I'm doing nothing. I'm following these sheep around the desert for 40 years. But then he met God in the burning bush. And you could point to that moment at the burning bush and say, this is when God called Moses in a major step forward into a whole new realm of authority. And you know what followed that major stepping stone for Moses? Opposition from the Israelites, opposition from Pharaoh, and 40 more years wandering the desert. It's like, thanks a lot, God. I thought this was a step forward. It was. It was a major step forward. But it wasn't going to be easy. And then those same children of Israel, after Moses led them through the desert, they crossed the Jordan under Joshua's leadership. They went into the city of Jericho. They came up with this really weird battle plan of just marching around the city of Jericho 7 times, and the walls fell down, and they had this major victory. So this was their moment, like they had finally reached the promised land. They were there, they were where God called them to be. But guess what? The whole promised land was still filled with peoples that needed to be driven out. They needed to be driven out. They had work ahead of them. It was not going to be easy. It was going to be very challenging. So we want to look this morning at David's experience once he finds himself in Jerusalem. He is now the man. He is king. He has become what he was prophesied to become. He is in Jerusalem. So we want to look at a couple things. First, I want to look at a challenge that David experienced, a pre-Jerusalem challenge, and then we're going to kind of use it to compare against two challenges that we'll look at in actually when he was king in Jerusalem. So we're going to go back to before he got to Jerusalem to a story that I think sort of starts us on this journey. And we're going to find this one in 1 Samuel 25. So I invite you to turn there. We're going to read through this, 1 Samuel 25. If you're using one of the guest Bibles under the seat in front of you, you'll find this on page 209. 209. Now, if you are filling in your notes in your program, I don't have a PowerPoint up here this morning, but this first point we're looking at is in this story about David, a man named Nabal, and his wife Abigail. The notes in your bulletin is here David faced criticism. It's pretty simple, but David faces criticism. So let's look at the story and see how this unfolds. Chapter 25, verse 1, now Samuel died and all Israel assembled and mourned for him. They buried him in his home in Ramah. Then David moved down into the desert of Moen. A certain man in Moen who had property there at Carmel was very wealthy. He had 1,000 goats, 3,000 sheep, which he was shearing in Carmel. His name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail. She was an intelligent and beautiful woman, but her husband, a Calebite, was surly and mean in his dealings. While David was in the desert, he heard Nabal was shearing sheep. Now, just insert here, apparently the time that you would shear the sheep was like this major celebration. You know, you'd bring the sheep in and you'd shear the sheep and you'd have all this wool, kind of like the harvest, if you will, I guess, for a farmer who plants crops. So the shearing of the sheep was a very celebrative time. So verse 5, so he, David, sent 10 young men and said to them, go to Nabal at Carmel and greet him in my name. Say to him, long life to you, good health to you and your house, and good health to all that is yours. Verse 7, now I hear that it is sheep shearing time. This is still David's voice or David's message through his men. When your shepherds were with us, now that means David and his men who were in this territory. When your shepherds were with us, we did not mistreat them. And the whole time they were at Carmel, nothing of theirs was missing. So David and his men apparently were kind of like a protective force as they were in this area. Like they would watch out for the shepherds. They would make sure they were safe. There was make sure nothing was missing, meaning they didn't steal anything from them, nor did they let anybody else take advantage of the shepherds, who I guess are relatively defenseless. So verse 8, ask your own servants and they will tell you how we treated them, how we protected them. You know, ask your own servants. Reading on, therefore be favorable toward my young men, since we come at a festive time. Please give your servants and your son David whatever you can find for them. When David's men arrived, they gave Nabal this message in David's name. Then they waited. So here it comes. You ready for this? Verse 10. Nabal answered David's servants, who is this David? Who is this son of Jesse? Many servants are breaking away from their masters these days. Why should I take my bread and water and the meat I have slaughtered for my shearers and give it to men coming from who knows where? So there's the criticism. It's not horrendous, but just Nabal is saying, I don't know David. You know, all kinds of people are breaking away from their masters, being rebellious, doing their own thing. That wasn't true of David, was it? David was actually very loyal to his master, but he was actually fleeing from him because he was trying to kill him. Verse 12, David's men turned around and went back. When they arrived, they reported every word. David said to his men, put on your swords. So they put on their swords, and David put on his. About 400 men went up with David, while 200 stayed with the supplies. Okay, so one of the things we learn about David is David was a passionate man. Agreed? David was a passionate man. He was a man of passion, and sometimes his passion got him in trouble. This was one of those times. He responded, I believe, absolutely in the flesh. It's like, who is this guy criticizing us? We protected his shepherd. We're his shepherds. We helped them. And now he's accusing us of being like some rebellious who knows what. So David, and you'll hear in a few more verses what his intention was. Verse 14, one of the servants told Nabal's wife Abigail, David sent messengers from the desert to give our master his greetings, but he hurled insults at them. Yet these men were very good to us. They did not mistreat us, and the whole time we were out in the fields near them, nothing was missing. Now, it looks like Nabal didn't ask the shepherds whether what David said was true, but now these leaders, these men, are saying to the wife, look, what David says is true. They night and day, verse 16, night and day they were a wall around us. All the time we were herding our sheep near them. Now think it over and see what you can do. So they're going to Nabal's wife and they're saying, look, your husband just did something really stupid. He just insulted the men of David, completely unfounded. Abigail lost no time in verse 18. She took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 dressed sheep, 5 seahs of roasted grain, 100 cakes of raisins, 200 cakes of pressed figs, and loaded them on donkeys. Then she told her servants, go on ahead, I'll follow you. Verse 20, as she came riding her donkey into a mountain ravine, there were David and his men descending toward her, and she met them. David had just said, it's been useless, all my watching over this fellow's property in the desert, so that nothing of his was missing. He has paid me back evil for good. Now here's David's heart in verse 22. May God deal with David, be it ever so severely, if by morning I leave alive one male of all who belong to him. So David was planning on coming into Nabal's place, into his property, whatever, and killing every single man. That was his plan. That's what he was thinking of doing. I'm not going to read through verse by verse here, but if you read down through, basically Abigail got off of her donkey and pleaded with David, don't do this. Like, why should you do this? Yes, my husband is a fool, but why do you want to bring this guilt and this bloodshed onto your hands? You know, don't go there, basically, is what she said. And it's fascinating, all the things that she said. She obviously was familiar with David. She was familiar with the Lord's call in his life. So David responded in verse 32. David said to Abigail, praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, who has sent you today to meet me. May you be blessed for your good judgment and for keeping me from bloodshed this day and from avenging myself with my own hands. The condition of David's heart at this point in his life, at least in this situation, was such that he was responsive to this word of warning that came from this woman. And he turned from his evil plan. Abigail was able to intercept and turn David from this evil plan. Now, I just want to make one point here on this about this particular issue. I'll pose it in the form of a question. How do you respond to criticism? How do you respond to criticism? Criticism is a huge test. Now hear this. I believe criticism is a huge test of the security of your identity. Criticism is a huge test of the security of your identity. If you are secure in who you are, who God has called you to be, and that you're walking in the path that he's chosen for you, even with your failures and your mistakes, we all have those, but you're confident in who you are in God, what you can do with criticism is you can receive it and you can weigh it and you can let God speak to you about it. You know, David, this man Nabal, accused David of being like a rebel, a renegade, whatever, you know, and David could have just received that and said, is that true? No, that's not true. That's not my heart. That's not my motive. That's nothing about me. And he could have just laid it down and been on his way. But it really stirred something up in him. Criticism will expose those areas in your heart, I believe, where you are unsettled. And that is touched when someone criticizes you because you feel like you have to defend yourself or you have to deny something they're saying. So fortunately, David turned away from his wrath. He didn't do anything about his criticism. He let God deal with it. Well, if you read on in the story, God dealt with it. God made Nabal pay for this false criticism. It cost him his very life. David stepped back. He took his hands off. He left the criticism in the hands of God, and God dealt with it severely and quickly. Now, that was God's business. Maybe God won't always deal with your critic. Maybe he will. But you leave that up to him. You leave that up to him. So that's the first challenge. David faced criticism, and what did he do in this situation? At first, he acted in the flesh, But then he allowed Abigail to convince him otherwise, and he let God take care of it. Just tuck this away as we go on to the next two challenges that David faced. This role that Abigail played of coming before David and said, David, time out. Time out. Just wait a minute. Give thought to what you're about to do because it's not good. What you're planning on doing is not good. And she was able to change his mind. So just tuck that away. Let's go to the next challenge. And I think if you ask most people who know anything about David, you would say, what was David's biggest failure as king? They would likely say the word Bathsheba, right? So we're going to go there next. I'm sure many of you are familiar with that story. Now we're going to go to 2 Samuel. For in 1 Samuel, just go over to 2 Samuel chapter 11. 2 Samuel chapter 11. Now again, this is probably one of, if not the most well-known stories in the life of David, unfortunately. David and Goliath, one of the most well-known stories, but now then right behind that is David and Bathsheba, a little different story. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. Most of us know the details pretty well. I'll touch on them briefly. But this week, as I was going over this again, I saw it in a different light. I saw it from an angle I'd never seen before. I saw something in this story. I'm like, wow, I've always missed that. And the more I thought about it, the more I meditated on it, I felt this is really important. This was really significant with what's going on here. So let's just go to the story. 2 Samuel 11. We only need to read a few verses here to kind of get the nutshell of at least what initially happened. Verse 11, in the spring at the time when the kings go off to war, chapter 11, I'm sorry, verse 1, in the spring at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rahab, but David remained in Jerusalem. There's probably a sermon in that, David remaining in Jerusalem, like he wasn't with the troops where he probably should have been, but he was hanging out back at home. But we won't deal with that one today. Verse 2, one evening David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the palace. From the roof he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful, and David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, this is the person now coming back to report to David, isn't this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite? Now that's phrased as a question, but it wasn't a question. He was saying, look, this is who she is. This is the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Verse 4, David sent messengers to get her. She came to him and he slept with her. She had purified herself from her uncleanness, then she went back home. Verse 5, the woman conceived and sent word to David saying, I am pregnant. There you have it, right there. Just that's enough right there for a soap opera for weeks, right? David commits adultery. The woman that he commits adultery with gets pregnant. And now David has a problem on his hands. So just to say briefly here, I've always thought, I guess I never gave it a lot of thought, but I always looked at this situation and said, okay, this was a failure in David's life. He gave in to sexual temptation. That was the failure. It was a failure of sexual temptation. He gave in. He committed a sexual sin. And all that's true, but I think God showed me a different angle that I hadn't considered before. And this is the note that's in the few notes you have there. More than sexual temptation, David was tempted with abusing his power. Abusing his power. Let me say a little bit more about that. Just to be very practical, okay, I'm just going to be very practical. If any one of us men would go up to a woman on the sidewalk in Lancaster and say to her, I find you very attractive, two things would likely happen fairly quickly. With one hand, she would spray us with the can of mace that is in her purse. And with the other hand, she would be dialing 911 to report this creep who is talking to her. So for many, I mean, men, we get this. Women can struggle with this as well, but I think for men, we're all acquainted with this. We notice an attractive woman. We notice an attractive woman. She catches our eye. And where that thought can go is it can go somewhere in our mind that turns sinful. We begin having we don't just notice her beauty and thank God for his creation and move on. We actually linger there a little longer than we should, and we start having sinful thoughts about this woman that we just saw. And so we commit this sin at the thought level, at the mind level, at the heart level. But for many of us, it doesn't go further than that. But with David, he had that same chain of events, saw the beautiful woman. He may have praised God for his creation, but he kept on going from there, and he became lustfully attracted to her. But what was different about David? David was the king of all of Israel. And all he had to do was issue a statement to a servant and say, go get her and bring her to me, and that very thing would happen. Can you just imagine God's thoughts at that very moment when he's saying to himself, David, do you think this is why I've given you this type of power and authority to summon someone else's wife at your wish? Like, this is ridiculous. But David didn't get that. He was abusing his power that God had given him to build up the nation of Israel, to build up God's fame and God's renown, and David was using it for his own purposes. This is, unfortunately, not uncommon in our day. I've heard it said, I don't know how you prove this or percentages or whatever, but I've heard it said that almost every situation where a pastor, a business leader, a political leader gets caught up in some type of sexual sin, there is an element of abuse of power in there because of their position. Their position opened a door that other people might not have had the opportunity to walk through. Because of their esteem, because of their name is known, people admire them, whatever. So we could ask the question, are leaders power hungry? Like, is that why people become leaders? So they can exert that power and have their way in situations that are even sinful. Perhaps in some cases. But I think we have to remember that when a person moves into any position of leadership or authority, whether it be in a business, whether it be in a church, whether it be in the government, the enemy sees on their back a huge bullseye. Do you know what I mean by that? If the enemy can bring down a leader, that's like super bonus points because so many people will hear about it. If an enemy can bring down a pastor, that's like triple, quadruple super bonus points because not only will a lot of people hear about it, but people will have an opportunity to criticize the gospel and to criticize the sincerity of believers. So there you go again, another pastor just doing what all pastors love to do. This week, just this week on Wednesday, I was talking to a friend, and I heard that news that just caused my heart to sink every time I hear it. Another local pastor in the area, and I'm not going to say any more, apparently was forced to step down from their job abruptly because of sexual sin, something inappropriate though. And part of me can just hear the demons celebrating with the greatness of their victory when that happens. And I would just challenge you while we're on this little bit of a detour there. Look, I get it. When you hear about someone in leadership, especially a pastor, falling to that type of sin, I know that one of your initial reactions can be anger. How can someone who stands in front of people and teaches the word of God, how can they be so hypocritical that on Tuesday or Wednesday of the week, they are meeting some woman who is not their wife in a hotel room or whatever it is. Like, how could they possibly do that? Let me just speak for myself. I am capable of that. You have to know that about me. I'm capable of that, and not only am I, but so are you. We are all capable of doing the worst things. When we take our eyes off God, when we get caught up in our flesh, we're all capable of that. I don't care if you're a pastor. I don't care if you're a business leader. I don't care if you own your own company or if you're the president of the United States. We are all capable of that. And not only are we capable of that, the more of a position of authority you step into, the attacks will be greater in that area. So my challenge to you is simply this. When you hear that, just pray for that person. Pray for that person. Pray for others. I appreciate so much your prayers for me and for Molly in our role. Please continue that, because we do wear, I believe, a bullseye, a bigger bullseye. Look, we all have a bullseye, but I believe the more you step into a place of leadership or where people know you, the bullseye gets bigger. So we need to pray for one another in that regard. What level of authority do you walk in? Some of you have authority as parents. You have authority over your children. God has placed you in a position of authority. You have now children, these young ones, or maybe adult ones at this point, that look to you as a parent. Maybe for you, it is authority you have at work. Maybe you're a manager. Maybe you're a supervisor. Maybe you have two or three people answering to you. Maybe you have 20 or 30 people answering to you. Maybe you own a company, and everybody in the company looks up to you as the leader, the owner. Some of you work in education, and you're a teacher, and you're given a classroom of students that look to you. You are the authority in the room. God has given you the authority he has given you, whether it is as a parent, as a teacher, as an employer, as a manager, whatever it is, he's given you that authority for his purposes. And every one of you can be tempted in whatever role of authority you have to use it somehow for your own advantage, to take advantage of the people that you have authority over. That's what David did. Did you notice in this story, then we'll move on to the last one, there was an Abigail, so to speak, there was a voice of caution before David committed this sin. It was a servant when he came back and he says, isn't this the wife of Uriah? Now, I don't think you could speak too forcefully to a king, or very few people would be bold enough to do it, but that was his way of saying, David, dude, this is someone's wife. Unfortunately, David's heart did not respond to the servant as it did to Abigail, and he continued forward with his sin. So, when you step into new levels of authority, you must be aware that there will come with that a temptation to use that authority for your own benefit, and we must not do that. Let's go to one more yet. One more challenge. There are a lot of them, by the way. If you read through 2 Samuel of this history of David after he becomes king of all Israel, there was a challenge, one after the next, some really painful things happening in his own family, people trying to take away his kingship, some really painful stuff. But we're going to fast forward to pretty much the end of his reign and something that he did. Now, this one isn't maybe quite as well known, but turn to 2 Samuel 24. 2 Samuel 24. The heading in the NIV above 2 Samuel 24 says, David counts the fighting men. David counts the fighting men. That sounds innocent enough, right? Some of you may be familiar with this story. Others of you may not. Like I said, this one isn't quite as well known. But let's read through this. So we start in 2 Samuel 24, verse 1. Very interesting verse to start this. Again, the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he incited David against them, saying, go and take a census of Israel and Judah. Again, a census is just a counting of people, counting heads. Now, we have to pause there, because it says the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he incited David against them. Now, if you just read that, it sounds like God is actually tempting David to do something sinful. And if that's the only verse we had here, it'd be a little hard to argue that, but the history that's recorded in 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 King, much of that is repeated in 1 and 2 Chronicles. You know how in the New Testament, like the Gospels, will often tell the same story? Maybe with little nuances from the writer, maybe a little detail is added. Well, it's kind of the same thing where Samuel and Kings has a parallel account, and that is Chronicles. So it's important in this particular one, especially, that we look at Chronicles. So if you're just holding your Bible there in 2 Samuel, you'll go through 1 and 2 Kings, that comes next, and then after 2 Kings is 1 Chronicles. And we want to go to 1 Chronicles chapter 21 to see how this author describes what incited this decision for David to take this census. Now it's interesting, the way it's communicated a little bit differently. 1 Chronicles 21, verse 1, it says this: Satan rose up against Israel and incited David to take a census of Israel. Now you notice that? In Samuel, 2 Samuel, it said that the anger of the Lord burned against Israel. And in 1 Chronicles, it says Satan rose up against Israel and incited David to take a census of Israel. So you might say, well, it seems like these two passages are actually contradicting one another. This is what I believe is happening. Now, we could debate this probably from several different angles. Let me ask it in a form of a question to help develop what I think is happening. When Job, the man that many of you are familiar with this story, Job had nearly everything that he had, a very wealthy man, he had nearly everything that he had taken away. Tremendous, tremendous, painful loss in the life of Job. Who was responsible for that? God or Satan? Who was responsible for the things that happened to Job? Well, here's how it played out. If you go there and read it, we won't do it now. Satan came to God and said, "Let me go after Job. I want to go after him." God, in that moment, simply could have said, "Nope, it's not going to happen," and the matter would have been settled. But God did not say that. God gave Satan permission to go after Job. Now, who's responsible for it? Is it Satan or is it God? We could argue about that all day long. But let me give you one other example. Do you remember when Jesus looked at Peter right before Jesus was crucified, before he was arrested, and he said to Peter, he said, "Satan has asked to sift you as wheat." We have this little glimpse again into this thing that when Satan wants to attack someone, he has to ask God. And this is the part that's really hard to hear. It's really hard to hear, but apparently there are cases where God says, "Okay." That's hard to hear. And I know that we talk about satanic attacks in our lives and things that we feel are happening, that like the enemy just seems to be opposing us at every turn. It's important. I believe we see it here. I believe we see it in Job. I believe we see it with the situation with Peter in the New Testament. There are times when God says, "Okay." Now, I take comfort in knowing that I have a loving Father who wants nothing but the best for me. So if he says yes to the enemy's request to come after me in some area, first of all, he will not let him destroy me. But secondly, there has to be a purpose. There has to be something God wants to do, whether it's in me or somehow through the circumstances. We're talking about really big stuff here, the workings of God, the wisdom of God, what he allows, what he doesn't allow. Man, I can't begin to scratch the surface of that. But I believe that's what happened here. I believe Satan came to God and said, "I want to tempt David to do a census of Israel," because Satan knew what the consequences would be. And God, in his providence, apparently gave the okay. That's why I believe in 2 Samuel, the wording is that the Lord incited David he allowed this temptation to happen. Okay, that's enough time on that probably. But just that, if you feel in your life like the enemy is opposing you, just go to God and say, God, what is happening and what am I supposed to be learning? Why am I going through this? What is the purpose you have for me? So anyway, we go on from there, reading now in this thing of go and take a census of Israel and Judah. Now your question at this point might be, what is the big deal? Why is this even wrong? Like taking a census, governments do it all the time. Leaders do it all the time. Let's just read on, verse 2. So the king said to Joab and the army's commanders with him, go throughout the tribes of Israel from Dan to Beersheba and enroll the fighting men so that I may know how many there are. So this was specifically a census of the army, of the fighting men. Now get this, verse 3. Here you're about to hear the voice of Abigail using that analogy. It's not actually Abigail's voice, it's Joab's voice, but notice what he says. Joab replied to the king in verse 3, may the Lord your God multiply the troops 100 times over, and may the eyes of my lord the king see it. But why does the Lord the king want to do such a thing? Joab, his military commander, is standing in front of David and said, what are you thinking? He didn't use those words, but that's how I might say it. What are you thinking? Why do you want to do this? Why do you want to do this? So we have to stop there and say, what is the deal? Why was Joab so concerned about this? Well, if you look back in Exodus 30, God says very clearly that you are not to take a census of the people unless at the same time each of the people would give an offering to redeem themselves. And that can be kind of confusing, but I think the basic idea was God says, if you're going to start counting the people, there has to be a reminder that every single one of these people are my people. They belong to me. So David, by counting the fighting men, apparently was coming at this from the wrong direction, and Joab warned him. Well, I won't read through the whole thing again. We're getting late here. But David ignored Joab's warning. He did it anyway. He commanded Joab and all of his commanders, like, go do it. Go do what I told you to do. I ordered you to count the fighting men. Go do it. I don't want to hear from you anymore. Just go do it. So they went and did it. It took almost 10 months to go through all of Israel to number all the fighting men, and they came back, and they reported to David. In verse 9, Joab reported the number of the fighting men to the king. In Israel, there were 800,000 able-bodied men who could handle a sword, and in Judah, 500,000. That's 1.3 million soldiers were identified in this census. Verse 10 is interesting. David was conscience stricken after he had counted the fighting men, and he said to the Lord, I have sinned greatly in what I have done. Now, fortunately, unlike the Bathsheba incident, we didn't read the whole way through that, but David just went further and further in his path of sin. He tried to cover up the incident with Bathsheba through a couple different devious ways. When that didn't work, he had her husband killed in battle so that he could marry her, quote, legally. And it wasn't until Nathan the prophet came to him and basically said, look, this is what you're doing. God sees it, and he is very displeased. It wasn't until that moment that David really felt a burden and a grief for his own sin. But here, for whatever reason, verse 10, David was conscience stricken, and he said to the Lord, I have sinned. So, again, just going on from there, I won't read through, but basically God gave David three options to be punished. One was to experience three years of famine in the land, 3 months of being pursued by his enemies, or 3 days of suffering a plague from God himself. And David chose 3 days because he thought God would be more merciful than either the famine or the enemy nations. And again, I'm not going through all the details here. You can read more of that. The difficulty with this story is nowhere is it specifically named what David's sin was. I mean, he did do the census without following God's ordained way of doing a census. But what's going on in his heart? Like, why was he even doing a census in the first place? We're not given any indication that there was like a big battle Like maybe you could see if, okay, here's an army, an enemy nation coming, and their army is 2 million strong, and David's thinking, well, what should we do? Like should we attack them head on? Should we kind of go around the sides or whatever? And maybe numbers would be useful in that. I still don't think that's God's way of going into warfare. He rarely did that. Just think of Gideon. God sent the poor guy into warfare against a massive army with, what was it, 300 people. And so there's a couple things that David might have been doing here. We don't really know. I would just suggest them. Again, this thing of ownership, you only count what you own. Maybe David was sort of in this thing of, these are my soldiers. These are this is my army. I want to number my army. The challenge for each of us here is to hold loosely those things that God has given you. Hold loosely those positions maybe that God has brought you into, because he owns them. He can take them away whenever he chooses. He can give you more whenever he chooses. It might have been an ownership issue. It might have been a lack of trust thing. You know, there's great trust and security in numbers. Does anybody know that? There's great security in numbers, like the balance of your bank account. There's great security on that if the number is like larger rather than smaller. There's great security if the number of your soldiers is larger rather than smaller. And even in a matter as simple as when people learn that I'm a pastor, if I meet someone that hasn't met me before and say, yeah, I'm a pastor. Oh, where do you pastor? I say, well, Living Hope Community Church. It's a church west of Lancaster. Do you know what almost without fail, what their next question is? They don't ask me, what's the vision of your church? They don't ask me, what do you feel God has called you to? What's your unique place in Lancaster County? What is God teaching you in this season? How is God using your people in this season? What is your role in God's kingdom in Lancaster County? They don't ask me those things. You know what they ask me? How big is your church? How many people? We take security in that. So when I say a number, some people are like, wow, okay, that's a good sized church. But if I said 3,000, I bet they would be like, whoa, man, you are the man. 3,000 people? And I bet if I said 12, they probably wouldn't say it, but they would probably go home thinking, oh, that's cute. A church of 12 people. A church of 12 people. That's so cute. We get wrapped up in numbers. We can put trust in them. They make us feel secure. God doesn't find security, doesn't want us finding security in any of that stuff. Our security's in him. It doesn't matter if this church is 12 people or 1,200 people. He's not that concerned about it, and I'm not either. I mean, just so you know, like people ask me at times, well, what's your vision for Living Hope? How many people are you looking for? I'm like, I don't have a number. I don't do numbers, okay? Church growth to me is when the lives of individuals, they're growing in the Lord and they're strengthening in the Lord. If God's purpose is to make Living Hope a church of 1,000 people, hey, that's fantastic. That's up to him. If his purpose is in time to make Living Hope a church of 12 people, I don't really like that, but hey, it's up to him. I mean, the numbers is up to him. I'm not real concerned about that. I'm more concerned about faithfulness and doing what he calls us to do. But just moving on through, lack of trust. This census thing could have been a control thing. You know, censuses are used to determine taxes, to set up like military drafts, all kinds of things like that. It could have been a control issue. I think probably, though, if I had to guess, and this is what's in your notes, here David may have been motivated by pride. This is what I really think was happening. You know, imagine how he could puff his chest out when he say, I am now the king of all of Israel, and I have an army of 1.3 million fighting men. That had to feel pretty good to be able to say that. You know, when his buddies are watching the Eagles tonight, he said, yeah, you know, I lead an army of 1.3 million men. 1.3 million with an M. That's how big my army is. This could have been very flattering for him, but I'm sure you know this already, but pride is a killer of godly influence and impact. We must continuously acknowledge that God and God alone receives any credit for what he allows us to do. So those were a few challenges that David faced and challenges that we will face. We will be tempted. with reacting against criticism. In our flesh, we'll want to go after somebody who comes after us. We'll be tempted to this thing with abuse of power, this thing of using the place that God has put us for our own purposes. And yes, we will be tempted with looking at where we are in life right now, wherever it is for you, and feeling a little bit of pride. But look where I am now. It's further than what I was 5 years ago. I've done a good job. No, God has worked through you, and God has enabled you to do whatever it is he's called you to do. So we're wrapping up this series on David this morning. At least I think we are. I don't have any more sermons planned. I just love these things about David. He was a man with sinful inclinations. David was a man with a sinful nature. Do you know that about him? You can see that in his story. David got it wrong sometimes, but yet the Bible still records all of that. We know about that. That's not hidden from us. He got it wrong sometimes, but when he got it wrong, what did he do? He repented. He repented. Even if it took him a while to see it, if his skull was a little thick, eventually he got it and he repented and we wanted to get right with God. And this goes back to something I said, was it last week, I believe? David's failures did not undo God's purposes or his place for David. God had this place for David. He had this plan for David. He was anointed to step into this role, and David started this godly line of kings, and Jesus himself was a descendant of David, king of Israel. And just because he messed up, it didn't alter God's plan. More than anything else, David is described as a man after God's own heart. So you need to hear that this morning. You can be a man or a woman after God's own heart, even if you've made some stupid mistakes, even if you've suffered from setbacks. And maybe this morning, right now, you're in a place where you're thinking like, man, I've totally screwed up. I am so far from God right now. Like, he doesn't have the time of day for me. No. God's plans and purposes are not altered by your mistakes. You simply have to repent. You have to put your eyes back on him, and he's going to keep taking you wherever he wants you to go. You can be a man after God's own heart, a woman after God's own heart, even with your imperfections, because we all have them. David had them, and we all have them. So you could ask the simple question, well, Ron, after you've talked about the challenges we'll face and the difficulties, why would I even want to step up? Why would I want to step forward? Why would I want to see God use me in a bigger way? The joy that comes from serving him, the joy that comes from seeing God use you, even in the midst of the challenges, is just indescribable. I mean, talk to somebody you know that you think as God has been stepping forward, that moving forward. Talk to Deb Ward, sitting right here. I was talking about you earlier, Deb. Talk to Deb. Deb will tell you about some of the challenges she has faced in her role, right? You've talked to me about, Reddy, you've said that to me, like, man, it seems like the enemy is just opposing us. We have disagreement here and dissatisfaction, whatever, you know, in this whole ministry. But I know Deb well enough to say that she would not stop what she's doing. She would not trade that in for anything just because there have been challenges. The joy that comes from stepping forward into what God calls you to is tremendous. And that is, our reward is joy. Our reward is joy. So, we're going to wrap up there this morning. I just want to encourage you, step forward. Step into what God's calling you into. That identity that he's revealing, walk in that. Step in that. You will face challenges. You will face obstacles along the way, but God will give you all that you need. I'm going to ask the worship team to come back. We're just going to circle back to the last song we sang to end the set this morning. As I was thinking about this sermon and thinking about David, my mind went to a simple prayer that was prayed by a tax collector that Jesus drew attention to in the New Testament. Some of you, just when I say that, you might remember what the prayer was. This tax collector goes into the temple, and he just falls on his face before the Lord, and he says, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. And I would suggest this morning that as God is calling you forward, as he is moving you into higher places, as he is moving you into greater levels of authority or influence, whatever they are, stay in that place. Stay in that place. where you admit, like, God, you had to have made a mistake. I have no idea why you would ask me to do this or put me in this position, but because you have, I will be faithful. And I know that you will make me brave, like we sang earlier. But David, I think, got himself into trouble when he kind of walked away from that place of, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. And he started looking around and he started saying to himself, you know what? I'm the king of this place. I'm the king of this place. I got quite a bit of authority. I have quite a bit of power. I don't know exactly how it all went down. But for you and I to remain in that place of, God, we will serve you. We will do what you call us to do. And every step of the way, we will be reminded that we cannot do this without you. We need you, because apart from your leading us, apart from your empowering us, we're not going to get it right. So we stay in that place of, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. We stay in that place of just confessing, God, I need you. And with you and through you, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me, but it's through him. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to invite you to stand, especially for those of you who felt like the Lord was calling you or just identifying a step, whether you came forward or not this morning, especially for those of you, just declare this song again this morning, that this is how you will reach that place of identity that God is calling you to. It's through your admission and awareness of our need for him. Team.